Right. We're now on to part 5, I think it is, of our study of the Gospel according to the Apostle John. And we're up at chapter 11 at the moment. I think we rather hurried through chapter 11 last week, or so was told afterwards. So we'll have to repeat, I think, at least part of that. But as a quick resume, you remember that the book of John could be divided into sort of two main parts. We could call chapters 1 through to the end of chapter 12 perhaps the book of signs, because the Apostle John takes the time to tell us about 7 special signs that Jesus did that John thinks are very important. And then perhaps chapters 13 through to 20 could be the book of Jesus' return to glory. It deals with the end of Jesus' physical life, the crucifixion, his resurrection, and so on. And thus far, we have now virtually seen all the 7 signs that John chose to record. You remember, sign 1 was the water at the wedding at Cana being turned into wine. John says that's the first of Jesus' signs. Then, shortly afterwards, we saw the sign of Jesus healing the nobleman's son who was sick unto death. And Jesus did that by speaking from several miles away from where the young boy was. Then the third sign was the man who was infirm for 38 years by the pool of Bethesda, and Jesus healed that man. The fourth of the 7 signs was Jesus feeding 5,000 men plus numerous women and children, perhaps as many as, well, who knows, 10,000, 12,000, 15,000. Sign 5 was Jesus walking on the water. Sign 6, we covered at some depth last week, was the man blind from birth, whom Jesus made a spitball and rubbed in his eyes, and he went to the pool of Siloam, washed it off and came back seeing. And the Pharisees and the Jewish leaders were so impressed that they threw the man out of the synagogue. He was excommunicated. And then the 7th sign is where we're picking up again today in John chapter 11. The 7th sign, the last sign, was Lazarus being raised from the dead. And that was chapter 11, the first 40-something verses. And we won't read the whole thing again, but you'll recollect that Lazarus had 2 sisters, Martha and Mary. They lived in a small town near Jerusalem, the town of Bethany, and Lazarus was clearly very, very sick, because, in fact, he died. And so his sisters sent an urgent message to Jesus to come, and presumably to, in some way, to heal Lazarus of his sickness. Now, the impression you sometimes get, if you just read through rapidly, is, well, you know, maybe Jesus stayed away for several days in order to let Lazarus die. In other words, it was deliberate. Jesus could have got there in time, could have healed him, but chose not to. We see that if you read chapter 11 and verse 6, you can read there, when Jesus heard that Lazarus was sick, he stayed there 2 more days in the place where he was. So you think, ooh, I wonder why Jesus did that. He's stayed there for 2 days. Was that to allow Lazarus to die so that Jesus could do a more spectacular miracle of raising him from the dead? It doesn't really quite fit. That would seem a bit, in a sense, harsh of Jesus to let the man die deliberately to raise him from death. And what it seems in reality was that by the time Jesus got the message, Lazarus was in fact already dead. Jesus was staying some distance from Bethany, not sure exactly how far, but when Mary and Martha would send a message, they wouldn't pick up the cell phone, just dial, you know, Jesus' number. And you wouldn't jump on into a taxi and zoom off. You have to say, well, now Jesus, we think, was last heard of over there in this particular area. Now let's send a messenger or messengers to Jesus, and that would take a number of hours, perhaps half a day, perhaps a whole day to walk, maybe 20 miles, something like that. And by the time Jesus heard the message, in reality, it would seem Lazarus was already dead. And then Jesus, yes, waited two more days, and then Jesus walked with his disciples back to Bethany to see what was going on. That would take Jesus perhaps another day or near enough. If you look down at verse 17, we see that when Jesus came to meet Martha, he found that Lazarus had already been in the tomb 4 days. So Jesus waited two. Lazarus had been in the tomb 4 days, allowed one day for Jesus to walk to Bethany, and one day perhaps for the messengers to get to Jesus. So in all likelihood, it seems that Lazarus' sickness was so severe and so rapid that he was already dead when Jesus got there. And as to why Jesus waited two more days, we said last week, well, there was apparently a superstition among some Jews, probably, to be fair, lots of them, that your soul, which they unfortunately believed in, because they didn't believe the Old Testament scriptures, they thought the soul would sort of hang about the body for a little while before zooming off to wherever souls go. And it may have been, this is speculation, that Jesus waited for about 4 days to make sure everybody understood that Lazarus was really dead, dead, dead. And therefore, Jesus knew what was going to happen. He knew he would resurrect Lazarus back to life, and nobody could argue about this being just Lazarus is swooning for a few hours and just coming back to life normally. This was quite definite. Lazarus was dead, just like Rover. He was dead all over. And so let's pick up the story in verse 21. Martha said to Jesus, "Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died. But even now I know that whatever you ask of God, God will give you." And she's saying, if you'd been here, Jesus, I know you could have healed him, because, you know, she'd seen other miracles. She'd heard of other miracles. She knew Jesus gave sight to the blind, cleansed lepers, allowed the lame to walk. But of course, Jesus had not been there. And 23, Jesus said to her, "Your brother will rise again." Now, Jesus meant, like, in the next hour or so. But Martha said to him, "I know that he will rise again in the resurrection at the last day." You know, she was not really believing things would happen there and then. She was saying, yeah, I know that, Lord. I know that at the last day, way off somewhere in the future, you know, my brother Lazarus will rise again. And Jesus said to her, verse 25, "I am the resurrection and the life." One of Jesus' "I am" statements. "He who believes in me, though he may die, he shall live. And whoever lives and believes in me shall never die. Do you believe this?" No, Martha. She said to him, it didn't really answer his question if you think about it. He says, "Do you believe that? Do you believe that somebody who dies can live again?" And she said to him, "Yes, Lord, I believe that you are the Christ, the Son of God, who is to come into the world." Which wasn't actually the question that Jesus asked her. So she sort of rather avoided. Perhaps she grasped that Jesus was implying he's going to do something special, but her brother's been in the grave, you know, 4 days. This is perhaps a bit too much of a stretch of her faith. So, well, I believe you are the Messiah. You are the Son of God. Oh, I believe that. Yes, I believe that. But Jesus' question, she rather skirted it. Verse 27, she said to him, "Yes, Lord, I believe you, the Christ, the Son of God, who is to come into the world." And when she had said these things, she went her way and secretly called Mary, her sister, saying, "The teacher has come and is calling for you." So it looks like Jesus had asked that a message be brought privately to Mary to come to him. Verse 29, as soon as she heard that, she arose quickly and came to him. Oh, the teacher's here, the teacher's here. And that's how they clearly saw Jesus, the teacher, the rabbi. Now Jesus, verse 30, had not yet come into the town, but was in the place where Martha had met him. Then the Jews, who were with Mary in the house and comforting her, when they saw that Mary rose up quickly and went out, followed her, saying, "Ah, she's going to the tomb to weep there." And it seems the culture of the day was that when there was a death in the house, people would come and stay with you for perhaps about a week, through your period of grief, to support you, to encourage you, and to weep with you. And sometimes it was quite a debacle, quite noisy, all the weeping and wailing and all the rest of it. Sometimes it was quite upset Jesus, the sheer amount of grief and the noise and so on. Verse 32, "Then when Mary came where Jesus was and saw him, she fell down at his feet, saying to him, 'Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died.'" And you don't know if that's perhaps even a slight little dig at Jesus. You know, you're too late. If you'd been here, if you'd got here in time, if you'd sort of levitated across wherever you were, if you'd known these things and not been away at the time, if you'd been here. Anyway, she thinks, well, if you'd been here, you could have done something, but obviously it's too late now because our brother is dead, and he's decomposing in the grave, and I guess that's that. So she's obviously very sad. She's grief-stricken. Her brother, I would guess, is still a fairly young man, a friend of Jesus, but you weren't here, Lord. You weren't here. I'm not sure if that's a little bit of a accusation. Verse 33, "Therefore when Jesus saw her weeping," and that means a loud wailing, "and the Jews who came with her weeping," meaning loud wailing, "he groaned in the spirit and was troubled." Now, interesting, the Greek there for groaned in the spirit, apparently is a word that's used of a horse snorting with anger in the Greek. So it rather implies that Jesus was getting quite indignant at what he saw here, because what he was seeing was really people who were limiting him. Nobody, it seemed, could believe that Jesus could do something. He was there, he knew he was going to do. He said earlier to his disciples, you look at verse 11, same chapter, verse 11, "These things Jesus said, and after that he said to them, 'Our friend Lazarus sleeps,'" meaning is dead, "'but I go that I may wake him up.'" So Jesus knew from a couple of days earlier, "I'm going to raise my friend Lazarus from the dead." But he's arrived now and there's just grief, there's disbelief. He's tried hard to get Martha, in particular now Mary, to believe in the resurrection. And they're all saying, "Well, if you'd been here, but you weren't here, wail, wail, weep, weep." And Jesus, it says, in essence, is a snorting like a horse with anger, indignant. We've read before, have we not, that without faith, it's impossible to please God. And here Jesus just sees these people, they can't grasp it. They can't understand, they can't see. He's nearing the end of his mission. Only another couple of months to go, I guess. And here he's closest friends, and they can't understand what he can do. Verse 34, "And he said, 'Where have you laid him?' They said to him, 'Lord, come and see.'" And then it says, "Jesus wept." Now, the Greek word for wept here is different from the weeping of Mary and Martha and the other Jews. This wept is a term meaning shed tears. Jesus shed silent tears. His eyes brimmed with tears. That's the shortest verse, I guess, in the Bible. John 11:35, Jesus wept. Shed silent tears. He was sharing, if you like, in the pain. But he knew what was going to happen. But he could see he was compassionate. You know, Jesus was not you think of what, you know, John, the apostle, is recording this. He's saying, in writing, "Do you know, people, that Jesus actually shed tears? Do you know that? Jesus is the Son of God and he shed tears over what was happening to his friends. Do you know that?" Because if you think of what was common in the New Testament world, people with their Roman gods and Greek gods, like, you know, Zeus and Apollo and so on, their gods were cantankerous, violent, hard, vindictive. And here we're talking about the Son of God, and he actually is able, prepared, and indeed will, shed tears. What does that say about our God? What does that say about our older brother? He's a real person, and he was moved by what he saw and shared in the compassion, if you like, towards these people. They were really still so ignorant and so filled with grief and so lacking in understanding. And on the one hand, he's indignant about their lack of faith. On the other hand, he's moved as he, if you like, shares in their suffering. Jesus is a real person. If you turn, hold your place there, of course, with your famous $50 bill, go down to Hebrews, a couple of places, Hebrews 2:14, if we begin there. Hebrews chapter 2 and verse 14. John deliberately chose to write, the Son of God shed tears, because to John that was, I guess, an important point to record. We need to know who our father is and who our older brother is and what they're like. Well, they're real. And Jesus is real. And he understands. He's been here. We've talked before about Jesus has been here and done it and got the t-shirt. Well, he has. Chapter 2 and verse 14 of Hebrews, we read, "Inasmuch then as the children have partaken of flesh and blood," talking of Jesus, "he himself likewise shared in the same." Jesus shares, or shared, should say, flesh and blood, just like you, and just like me, that through death he might destroy him, or nullify him, who had the power of death, that is the devil, and release those who through fear of death were all their lifetimes subject to bondage. For indeed, he does not give aid to angels, they don't really need it, but he does give aid, assistance, or help to the seed of Abraham. Therefore, in all things, he, Jesus, had to be made like his brethren, that he might be a merciful and faithful high priest in things pertaining to God, to make propitiation for the sins of the people. For in that he himself has suffered, being tempted, he is able to aid those who are tempted. Why? Because Jesus has been here. Jesus has been tempted in every respect, like you and like me. Jesus partook of flesh and blood. When he was there with Martha and Mary, and could see their tears and their misunderstandings and their lack of faith, Jesus shed tears. Another time, of course, he came to Jerusalem, and it says he shed tears over the city because he knew what was coming, and he knew they were just so blind, and his eyes brimmed over with tears. Jesus is real. He has compassion. If you turn to chapter 4 and starting in verse 14, Hebrews chapter 4, and picking up in verse 14, we read here, "Seeing then that we have a great high priest who has passed through the heavens, Jesus, the Son of God, let us hold fast our confession. For we do not have a high priest who cannot sympathize with our weaknesses, but was in all points tempted as we are, yet," in Jesus' case, of course, "without sin." So Paul writes here that Jesus, he says, cannot. He says, we do not have a high priest who cannot sympathize, or you could rephrase that, we do have a high priest who can sympathize with our weaknesses. And Jesus was in all points, every point, tempted as we are. There's nothing wrong with temptation. Jesus was tempted in every point, whatever you've been tempted with, whatever temptations I faced, Jesus has been there. He's faced them because he partook of flesh and blood. Now, in Jesus' case, thankfully, he never yielded to temptation. It's a yielding to it is where the sin comes in. Being tempted is not a sin. Jesus never sinned, but he was tempted. Quite a lot, I would imagine, because no doubt Satan and his demons and his agents would make every attempt possible to lead Jesus astray in one way or another, provoke him, seduce him, whatever it might take. But notice in verse 15 there, Jesus does sympathise with our weaknesses. Jesus has compassion. Jesus shed tears when he was a human being. Verse 16, let us therefore, meaning because Jesus is in heaven, because he does understand, because he does sympathise, because he's been tempted, let us therefore come boldly to the throne of grace, that we may obtain mercy and find grace to help in time of need. And then we go back to John. So, you know, Jesus wept, shed tears. Jesus was a real human being at this stage with real feelings, just like you and just like me. Verse 36, John 11. Then the Jews, well, you see, the Jews, we've said this before, they're all Jews. You know, Mary was a Jew, Martha's a Jew, John was a Jew, Philip, they're all Jews. So what it particularly means in John's Gospel is really the Judeans, those that came from Judea in the south of the country, versus the Galileans. And if you think about it, you know, of the 12 apostles, 11 were apparently Galileans. And only one apostle was a Judean. You can guess perhaps which one that was. We come to him a bit later. So anyway, verse 36, then the Jews or the Judeans said, see how he loved him. But some of them said, well, could not this man who opened the eyes of the blind also have kept this man from dying? So there's still a division among the Jews here. Some saying, oh, didn't he really love Lazarus? I was like, yeah, but why couldn't he have stopped him dying? Then Jesus, verse 38, again groaning in himself. Again, that's that expression of being indignant, like a horse snorting with anger, came to the tomb. It was a cave, and a stone lay against it. Jesus said, take away the stone. Now, it's quite clear at this stage, nobody believes, because Martha, the sister of him who was dead, said to him, Lord, by this time there's a stench, for he's been dead 4 days. And she's thinking, what's going on here? Is Jesus going to go in and pay his last respects to him, or what's this all about? But you can't do that, Lord. Look, he's been dead 4 days. You know, and this sort of, you know, hate and so on, there'll be decomposition and you know, a stench. Well, the King James uses an older, rather rougher word, stinketh. And you're thinking, yeah, I'll be right. We can all guess what it's like if you leave, you know, meat around for sort of 4 days and it's not in the fridge and it's in so warm, clammy conditions. You'll be like flies and nasty. Jesus said to her, verse 40, did I not say to you that if you would believe, you would see the glory of God? If you would believe. And of course, that's how Jesus would phrase it. Believe, and then you'll see. Whereas, of course, humanly, we have it the other way around. If we see, then we'll believe. After all, we all know that seeing is believing, as the Proverbs say. Well, not in God's world. In God's world, in Jesus' world, is believe and you'll see. Not the other way around. Verse 41, then they took away the stone from the place where the dead man was lying, and Jesus lifted up his eyes and said, Father, I thank you that you have heard me, and I know that you always hear me. But because of the people who are standing by, I said this, that they may believe that you sent me. This was an audible prayer, so that people would get the chance to believe. This is going to be a great sign. I mean, the only sign greater than this was, of course, Jesus himself rising from the dead. Verse 43, now when he had said these things, he cried with a loud voice, Lazarus, come forth. And he who had died came out. Interestingly, it says, bound hand and foot with grave clothes. And his face was wrapped with a cloth. And Jesus said to them, loose him and let him go. And that has to be, you know, absolutely outstanding. Just think what they were all looking at. I mean, some would have perhaps been almost hoping it would all work. Some would have thought this could never happen. I mean, this is he's going to fall down now. He's going to shout this and nothing's going to happen. And it's going to put an end to this guy's claims to be the Messiah. And they're all looking at this hole in the hillside where the cave is. And Jesus is shouting, you know, Lazarus, come forth. Somebody wrote that, well, Jesus had to put Lazarus' name in there because had there been other bodies around, and Jesus shouts out, come forth, maybe all these people resurrected. I suspect that probably wouldn't happen, but who knows. There's another scripture in John 5 says that one day all who are in the graves will hear his voice and come forth. So anyway, Jesus shouts, Lazarus, only, come forth. And of course he doesn't walk out, does he? Because he's bound hand and he's bound feet. So he can't walk out because he can't move his feet. So therefore, I'm assuming, he has to sort of like float or levitate. Just come out and he's all bound up like a mummy, wrapped up in grave clothes. He just sort of floats out, presumably floating 6 inches above the ground because he can't move his legs or his feet. They're bound up. And he can't see where he's going because, you know, it says his face is wrapped in a cloth. And he's probably wondering, what's going on? Because he's been dead for 4 days, and I don't think he was up in heaven strumming his harp, or anywhere else for that matter. Jesus said earlier, you know, Lazarus sleeps. And he said, I mean, he's dead. And Lazarus being dead was unconscious. He wasn't somewhere else. He didn't have a soul, despite what the Jews would have probably thought in those days. Lazarus was dead. And now Lazarus is just thinking, what's going on? I can hear voices out there, and what's happened to me? I remember being very ill, and, you know, and of course they rush across and take the cloth off his eyes, and now he's looking around and thinking, what's this all about? What's happened? And they're all looking at him, and people are shouting, and some are fainting, and some are dancing about. And, of course, they release him. We don't have any more details, but it must have been quite something, I would have thought. And what would Mary think? And Martha? And the other Jews, you know for a certainty that Mr. Lazarus had been dead for 4 days. No doubt, no question, not temporarily unconscious due to having fainted and being put early into his grave. This guy was dead all over. And there he is, in front of your eyes, talking and laughing and hugging his sisters. What do you make of that? Is that a sign or not? And could anybody doubt that? And surely at that point, the whole world would rush to Jesus and say, he clearly must be the Messiah. Only the heading of my next section of my Bible says, the Pharisees plan to kill Christ. Absolutely amazing. Verse 45. Then many of the Jews, I'll say Judeans, who had come to Mary and had seen the things Jesus did, believed in him. Well, many believed in him. Not all, even now. Verse 46, but some of them went away to the Pharisees and told them the things Jesus did. And I don't think that's telling them in the sense of what wonderful news we've got, Mr. Pharisee. It's a question of, oh, you wouldn't guess what's happened now. Now we're really in trouble. Verse 47, then the chief priests and the Pharisees gathered a council and said, what shall we do? For this man works many signs. If we let him alone like this, everyone will believe in him, and the Romans will come and take away both our place, our jobs, and nation. And you're just thinking, it's hard to believe this. Jesus just raised a man from the dead after 4 days, and these chief priests and these Bible students, these Pharisees, these experts in the law, and what are they saying? You know, what a fantastic miracle this is. We've never come across anything like that before. This man must be the genuine article. What they're saying is, oh no. Now everyone believe in him. Oh no. And then the Romans will come and they're going to take away our positions, our jobs. And, oh, by the way, take away the country as well while they're at it. But it was the jobs came first, I think, reading the order there, before patriotism. Just like good politicians, look after your job number one, and then perhaps look after your country. And one of them, verse 49, Caiaphas, being high priest that year, said to them, you know nothing at all, nor do you consider that it is expedient for us that one man should die for the people, and not that the whole nation should perish if the Romans invade. And now this he did not say in his own authority, but being high priest that year, he prophesied that Jesus would die for the nation, and not for that nation only, but also that he would gather together in one the children of God who were scattered abroad. So in a sense, you know, God inspired Caiaphas, not because he was good. He happened to be, you know, high priest, and therefore God could use him in a sense because of his office. And Caiaphas said words that he didn't understand, but in a sense prophesying that Jesus would die for the whole world. In verse 53, then from that day on, they plotted to put him to death. You know, incredible. These are religious leaders. Always be cautious about religious leaders. They don't have a good track record. These guys were so-called experts in the law. These are the ones that taught in the synagogues. These were the chief priests. And look what they're trying to do. They are plotting, scheming, working together, trying hard to find ways and means to get this man and have him killed. Really quite incredible. Therefore, unsurprisingly, Jesus no longer walked openly among the Jews or the Judeans, but went from there into the country near the wilderness to a city called Ephraim, and there remained with his disciples. So Jesus did the wise thing. He knows now these guys are out to kill me, but of course Jesus' hour has not yet come. So rather than hanging about in the Jerusalem area, Judea, Jesus takes off into the wilderness to this little town or city called Ephraim and remains there for, I'm guessing, something like 1 or 2 months, and takes time out. Verse 55, now we move on a bit, and now we're coming pretty much into the last week of Jesus' life, so we're getting very much to the end of the journey. And the Passover of the Jews was near. You remember, if you look at chapter 10:22, we had the Feast of Dedication in Jerusalem, and it was winter. So that was round about December-ish time, Hanukkah. And now we're at Passover, so something like about 3 months has passed from then to now. So the Passover of the Jews was near, and many went from the country up to Jerusalem before the Passover to purify themselves. Then they saw Jesus and spoke among themselves as they stood in the temple, what do you think, that he will not come to the feast? Now both the chief priests and the Pharisees had given a command that if anyone knew where he was, he should report it, that they might seize him. So I think in some earlier times, perhaps they'd been very much hush-hush and kept very quiet. Now it was a public announcement. You know, Jesus had a reward sign up in the temple, nailed there, wanted, Jesus of Nazareth, reward offered. And so it was now, you know, a public proclamation. We want this man. And so the Judeans and others saying, do you think he'll come to the feast? And of course, talking of the feast, it's really the Feast of Unleavened Bread. But the term Passover got sort of used rather, you know, loosely. Passover, we know, was the beginning of the 14th day of Abib, and the feast was the day after the 15th and ran for 7 days, the first day of the Feast of Unleavened Bread, the seventh day being Holy Days. But the whole period was loosely referred to as the Passover period, just like nowadays we talk of Christmas, and you'll hear a lot about that, of course, around you in the next few weeks. And people refer to Christmas not always meaning just December the 25th. What are you doing for Christmas, people ask each other? I mean, really over the break. You're breaking up a day or two before, you maybe have a week off work. What are you doing for Christmas? And they mean that period of time with Christmas tucked in the middle. And here people talk of, you know, the Passover sometimes more generally. So the Judeans are after Jesus. Then on to chapter 12. Then 6 days before the Passover, so, you know, John's being quite helpful with his timing here. We know this is just a week or so before the Passover. According to my marginal notes, which are possibly uninspired, it does say Wednesday evening. Bearing in mind Jesus crucified Wednesday the week later. And 6 days before Passover, Jesus came to Bethany, where Lazarus was, who had been dead, whom he had raised from the dead. So back to this little town, very close to Jerusalem. There they made him a supper, and Martha served, but Lazarus was one of those who sat at the table with him. This is probably a month or maybe 2 months after Lazarus was raised from the dead. And here is, you know, John's making the point, Lazarus is quite well. He's having a nice meal with Jesus in this house. Now, this is not Mary's house or Martha's house. Other Gospels, like Matthew, for example, tell us this is the house of Simon the leper. So it's in Bethany, perhaps a few doors away from Mary and Martha's. Can't be too far away, because Martha's come along to actually do what Martha does. Martha's obviously very good around the house, and she's here serving, which she does well, and that's pretty good. And Mary's got something else up her sleeve. So before we get too far along, let's turn to Matthew 26, because I want to read Matthew's version first of this coming episode. Matthew chapter 26, and we're beginning in verse 6 when we get there. Matthew 26, which is a parallel explanation. Matthew 26, and I think I said verse 6. And when Jesus was in Bethany at the house of Simon the leper, a woman, not identified here by name, but we'll see in a moment who that was, a woman came to him having an alabaster flask of very costly fragrant oil, and she poured it on his head as he sat at the table. So in those days, you know, you'd be reclining on sort of cushions and things around this this low table. And this, as yet unidentified woman, comes and pours this very costly, and we'll see how costly in a moment, very costly fragrant oil onto his head. And we find it elsewhere also onto his feet. But when his disciples saw it, they were indignant, saying, "To what purpose is this waste?" Or in our modern English, "What a waste! Why has this woman come and poured this expensive oil on Jesus', you know, head and feet? What a waste! What a waste! For this fragrant oil might have been sold for much," and it was much, by the way, "and given to the poor." And many people today would probably agree with them. So that's right. I mean, why did this woman come and pour a very expensive bottle of oil on this preacher, when, what a waste? You could have sold that and given that money to people that really need help. There are poor people out there in Bethany who can't eat, who can't drink, haven't got a home to live in. This is, what a disgraceful waste. How extravagant to give something of such value to a preacher. How much better to have given it to the poor. And I'm labouring this because if you find people saying things like, "What a waste, this should have been done instead so that it can be given to the poor," you might want to just check out who that's like. It says here, the disciples saw it, they were indignant and said this. We'll find out in a moment who it was who actually was the ringleader and whose words these were. And it shows, frankly, a poor attitude. And it's an attitude that, you know, we can all have today if we're not careful. I mean, if you find yourself thinking things like, "Well, why should so-and-so live in such a big house? You know, they should sell that and move down market and then give the balance to the poor. Why should so-and-so drive such a very expensive car? They don't need a car like that. They should buy a much cheaper car and give the balance to the poor. Why should they spend so much money on a holiday? They should stay at home and use that money and give it to the poor." Well, going to suggest we need to watch out that type of thinking, because frankly what other people do with their wealth and their resources is their business. And if we're tutting and talking about shameful extravagance like the disciples were here, there's a bit of a problem, as we'll see in a few more moments. Carry on in verse 10. When Jesus was aware of it, he said to them, "Why do you trouble the woman? For she has done a good work for me." He rebuked them. "For you have the poor with you always, but me you do not have always. For in pouring this fragrant oil in my body, she did it for my burial. Assuredly, I say to you, wherever this gospel is preached in the whole world, what this woman has done will also be told as a memorial to her." You know, Jesus thought it was a great what she'd done. It was extravagant to the disciples' eyes. To Jesus, it was what she'd done is wonderful. It was her oil. She chose to use it in this way. Why are you guys ganging up on her? You know, leave her alone. What she's done is great. And frankly, it's going to be recorded. And wherever the gospel of my life is told, this will be recorded too. So let's go back to John, because John has some more interesting details. Picking up in verse 12, and chapter 12, I meant verse 2. They made him a supper, and Martha served, and Lazarus was one of those who sat at the table with him. Then Mary took a pound of very costly oil of spikenard. Now we know who the lady was. It was Martha's sister, Lazarus' sister, Mary, who'd sat at Jesus' feet sometime earlier, listening and annoying her sister in the process, of course. Then Mary took a pound of very costly oil of spikenard, anointed the feet of Jesus, plus his head we saw earlier, and wiped his feet with her hair. And the house was filled with the fragrance of the oil, which John would have, obviously having been there, would have remembered that. Wow, it was a tremendous a scent in the air. Wow. Then one of his disciples, Judas Iscariot, Simon's son who would betray him, said, "Why was this fragrant oil not sold for 300 denarii and given to the poor?" So now we know who it was who said, "What a waste. What a waste. This could have been sold and given to the poor." It's Judas. And quite honestly, we don't want to be sharing the type of mentality that Judas had, or the attitude of Judas. "Oh, what a waste. Fancy doing that with their money. They could have done this and given it to the poor." It sounds religious, I'll admit that, but it's not godly. You know, Jesus could have stopped Mary at any point here and said, "Oh, Mary, I know what's in your mind. I can see it in your eyes. No, that's just foolish. Sorry, Mary. I love the idea and the thought. What a wonderful heart you've got. But I tell you what, let's not waste that oil. Let's sell it and give it to the poor." But Jesus didn't. It says here, verse 5, "Why was this fragrant oil not sold for 300 denarii? Well, that's approximately 1 year's wages. So let's call it roughly $25,000. Now, was Mary poor, by the way? Well, if Mary had in her personal possession a jar of oil worth $25,000, and Mary, and I would say Martha and Lazarus, were not poor. And Jesus was more than happy to receive this this offering, if you would call it that. And when the guys jumped up on her, Judas leading the way and some of the others obviously joining in, Jesus said, "Leave her alone. Frankly, boys, it's none of your business what she does with her money. That's her choice, her decision. And so leave her alone." And of course we find out what was leading Judas a moment or two more. It says, verse 6, "This Judas said, not that he cared for the poor, but because he was a thief and had the money box. He was the treasurer and used to take what was put in it." Then Jesus said, "Let her alone." And I don't think he said that too gently. She has kept this for the day of my burial. For the poor you always have with you, but me you do not have always. And so Jesus said, leave her alone, boys, leave her alone. And it says, you know, the reason that Judas was getting all agitated was not because he cared for the poor, verse 6. He didn't care at all. So he put on this false pretense. What a waste! They should have been sold and given to the poor. And it sounds like, oh, wow, Judas, what a man of, what a great heart you've got. What a religious man you must be. What a thoughtful man you are, Judas. He wasn't. He was a hypocrite, a pretender. And watch out for that attitude. If we want to sit there criticizing other people with what they do with their money and saying they ought to have put that into the gospel, they should put that into the poor. Is it jealousy? Envy? Is it another variation on coveting? Because that's what destroyed Judas. He was covetous. He wanted the money. And he was thinking, wow, what a waste! That could have been sold, $25,000 into the bank, and get a chunk of that into my personal bank account. And so we don't want to ever find ourselves sharing in the words or the attitudes or the intentions of Judas. We shouldn't criticize other people, in short, for what they're doing with their wealth. If we want to give to the poor, that's our decision for us to give to the poor, and not for us to start telling other people what they should be doing with their resources. None of our business, quite honestly. And I'm sure God can take care of situations there if and when he wants to. And where do we get to? Oh, verse 9. Then a great many of the Jews knew that Jesus was there, and they came not for Jesus' sake only, but that they might also see Lazarus, whom he had raised from the dead, because, you know, word getting around. Well, hey, Lazarus is there. Did you hear about Lazarus being raised from the dead? Well, I heard the story. Come on, let's go and see him. But the chief priests took counsel that they might also put Lazarus to death, because on account of him, many of the Jews went away and believed in Jesus. So these religious guys, I mean, they're really quite something, aren't they? Want to kill Jesus, and now Lazarus, I know he's resurrected, but this time when we kill you, you're going to stay dead, boy. It's like, what sort of attitude have these guys got? I mean, really quite vile. Verse 12. The next day, a great multitude that had come to the feast, when they heard that Jesus was coming to Jerusalem from nearby, you know, Bethany's only a couple of miles away, took branches of palm trees and went out to meet him and cried out, Hosanna! Blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord, the King of Israel. Then Jesus, when he had found a young donkey, sat on it, as it is written, Fear not, daughter of Zion, behold, your king is coming, sitting on a donkey's colt. It does seem that tradition would be that if any coming king arrived on a donkey, it was a sign of peace. If you arrived on a horse, it was probably a sign of war. So in a sense, this was like this coming king, which Jesus, of course, is, although this was not the time, he's coming in a, you know, in a picture of peace, riding on a donkey. Verse 16, his disciples did not understand these things at first, but when Jesus was glorified, then they remembered that these things were written about him and that they had done these things to him. So the scriptures, it's like, came later. Their understanding came later. Here they saw the events, they witnessed them, they heard them, they participated. But, you know, some months later they realized that, I tell you what, Peter, what's that, John? You know, when that happened on the way into Jerusalem, that was a fulfillment of this particular passage in Zechariah. Did you know that? Yeah, I think you're right, John. And so, you know, their understanding of the prophecies and how Jesus fulfilled them came to light later. At this stage, they still, quite honestly, were largely in the dark. You know, Jesus kept telling them, but it was like in one ear and, you know, rapidly out of the other. Verse 17. Therefore, the people who were with him when he called Lazarus out of the tomb and raised him from the dead bore witness. For this reason, the people also met him, because they heard that he had done this sign. These signs were quite dramatic. When you add them all up, they're amazing. The Pharisees therefore said among themselves, "You see that you're accomplishing nothing? Look, the world has gone after him." They're really being into panic at this stage. Now there were certain Greeks among those who came up to worship at the feast. Then they came to Philip, who was from Bethsaida of Galilee. And they were all from Galilee apart from one. You know who he was. And asked him, saying, "Sir, we wish to see Jesus." Philip came and told Andrew, and in turn Andrew and Philip told Jesus. But Jesus answered them, saying, "The hour has come that the Son of Man should be glorified." Now you'll remember in the past we've seen Jesus saying a number of times, "My hour is not yet." The hour is not yet, but now the hour was. And Jesus right up to the last just 2 or 3 days, there's not much time left. "The hour has come that the Son of Man should be glorified. Most assuredly I say to you, unless a grain of wheat falls into the ground and dies, it remains alone. But if it dies, it produces much grain or much fruit." I think we get the picture there. "He who loves his life will lose it, and he who hates his life in this world will keep it for eternal life. If anyone serves me, let him follow me, and where I am, there my servant will be also. If anyone serves me, him my Father will honor. Now my soul is troubled," or agitated. "What shall I say? Father, save me from this hour. But for this purpose I came to this hour. Father, glorify your name." And Jesus is struggling a bit. We can't think of Jesus as being some sort of stone-hearted robot that just went into the crucifixion and sailed through it. This was a struggle. Jesus is a human being here. He's flesh and blood, and he's now right up to the Passover, and he knows exactly what's going to happen. He knows the prophecies extremely well, and he knows what the Passover represents. He knows about the lamb being slain and his blood being poured out, and he knows he's only a few hours away from that. And it's difficult. We know elsewhere it talks about Jesus being in agony and sweating blood virtually. So here Jesus is saying, "Well, I'm troubled. Should I ask you to save me, Father? But how can I do that? It's the whole reason I came." Then verse 28, "Then a voice came from heaven saying, I have both glorified it and will glorify it again. Therefore the people who stood by and heard it said it had thundered." They heard a noise but couldn't make out what it said. Others said, "I think an angel has spoken to him." But Jesus obviously understood and heard, and it no doubt gave him encouragement to have his Father speak from heaven. Jesus answered and said, "This voice did not come because of me, but for your sake. Now is the judgment of this world. Now the ruler of this world will be cast out." And it says judgment, but Jesus didn't come to judge the world there and then. The Greek for judgment in this verse is a crisis. It's spelled like K-R-I-S-I-S, crisis. And it can mean like a decisive moment. This is the decisive moment. This is the crisis point of the world. Because as of now, the ruler of this world, Satan the devil, will be cast out. Verse 32, "And I, if I am lifted up from the earth, will draw all to myself." Meaning, if I'm crucified and lifted up. This he said, signifying by what death he would die. The people answered him, because they're now confused, "Well, just a minute. We've heard from the law that Christ remains forever. He lives forever. The Messiah, the anointed one, the Christ, he lives forever. How can you say the Son of Man must be lifted up and put to death? Who is this Son of Man?" And we thought the Christ and Son of Man were the same, but doesn't the scripture talk about Christ living forever, and yet you say the Son of Man is going to be lifted up? Well, we don't understand. Jesus said to them, "A little while longer the light is with you. Walk while you have the light, lest darkness overtake you. He who walks in darkness does not know where he is going. While you have the light, believe in the light, that you may become sons of light." These things Jesus spoke and departed and was hidden from them. So he took off for a few hours or a day or so. For although he had done so many signs before them, they did not believe in him, that the word of Isaiah the prophet might be fulfilled, which he spoke, "Lord, who has believed our report? And to whom has the arm of the Lord been revealed?" Therefore they could not believe, because Isaiah again said, "He has blinded their eyes and hardened their heart, lest they should see with their eyes and understand with their heart, lest they should turn so that I should heal them." Now, they couldn't see at that time. It wasn't their time. Still amazing that so many signs could be done, so much teaching, and people still can't grasp it. Verse 41, "These things Isaiah said when he saw his glory and spoke of him." Obviously, 700 years before in prophecy. "Nevertheless, even among the rulers, many believed in him," to an extent that would be, "but because of the Pharisees, they did not confess him, lest they should be put out of the synagogue, for they loved the praise of men more than the praise of God." Which is, of course, a damning indictment, isn't it? What do you look for more, men's approval or the approval of God? And these guys, it says they believed in Jesus. They knew a fair amount about him, not the whole story clearly, but they wouldn't admit it because they were scared they would be excommunicated. And so they went along with the crowd because they loved the praise of men more than the praise of God. And how about you? How about me, for that matter? You know, whom do we try and please with our conduct and behavior and words? Do we do things to gain the approval of neighbors and family and friends? Nothing wrong with your friends and so on approving you, but when it comes to the crunch, and one way will please God and a different way is required to please mankind, when you get to that type of choice, who wins in our mind? The people that can see us, or the God that we cannot see? Well, it's bad news if we love the praise of men more than the approval of our God. Then Jesus cried out and said, "He who believes in me," actually believes not in me, but in him who sent me, "and he who sees me sees him who sent me," because Jesus, you know, represented the Father. Verse 46, "I have come as a light into the world, that whoever believes in me should not abide in darkness. If anyone hears my words," you know, my message, "and does not believe, well, I do not judge him, for I did not come to judge the world, but to save the world. He rejects me and does not receive my words, has that which judges him, namely, the word that I have spoken will judge him in the last day. For I have not spoken in my own, but the Father who sent me gave me a command what I should say, what I should speak. And I know that his command is everlasting life. Therefore, whatever I speak, just as the Father has told me, so I speak." And if Jesus has spoken the words of eternal life, and you and I reject them, well, Jesus simply says, well, there's the truth. That's what you did. I'm going to judge you, really. The words will condemn you. Chapter 13. So chapter 13 really begins, if you want, this second portion. You know, we've had the book of signs right up there to the end of chapter 12, with John talking of many signs that people saw, and some believed and some didn't. And now chapter 13 through to the end of chapter 20, I guess, is the book of Jesus' return to glory, dealing with the last, you know, few days of Jesus' life, and then his crucifixion and his resurrection. So beginning in chapter 13 and verse 1, this is a passage that we, if you're baptized, you've probably read many a time on the night of Passover, but it can be read other times of the year, of course. Verse 1, and I've got this down as a Tuesday evening in my margin. "Now before the feast of the Passover," which would be, could be the holy day of unleavened bread, "when Jesus knew that his hour had come, that he should depart from this world to the Father, having loved his own who were in the world, he loved them to the end." And it says in my Bible, supper being ended, but it should more correctly be during supper. You can see that as we carry on, because it talks about Jesus doing various things and then eating afterwards, so it should be more correctly during supper. And during supper, the devil, having already put it into the heart of Judas Iscariot, Simon's son, to betray him, Jesus, knowing that the Father had given all things into his hands, and that he had come from God and was going to God, rose from supper and laid aside his garments, took a towel, and girded himself. Now, by this stage, Judas, well, we'll probably read that, turn to Matthew 26. Don't miss out an important point. Matthew 26. We were there earlier, so verse 13 is where we ended. This was Matthew talking about the woman with the alabaster flask of costly oil. Turns out, of course, to be Mary, Lazarus' sister. And we just read in verse 13, "Assuredly," says Jesus, "you know, leave this woman alone. I say to you, whatever this gospel is preached in the whole world, what this woman has done will also be told as a memorial to her." And he's rebuked the disciples for criticizing her. And the main disciple was, of course, Judas. Verse 14, "Then one of the 12, called Judas Iscariot, went to the chief priests and said, 'What are you willing to give me if I deliver him to you?' And they counted out to him 30 pieces of silver." So from that time, he sought opportunity to betray him. I put that down as the Monday. So when Jesus rebuked the disciples, and really the main rebuke was to Judas for jumping on poor Mary and saying, "What a waste! What a waste! We could have sold that and given it to the poor." But he was a liar and a hypocrite and covetous, and he wanted the money. And now he's raced straight out from there to the priests, and he's got money. He's got 30 pieces of silver. I think one place said it's worth about $5,000, perhaps. And now he's looking for a chance to betray Jesus. So back to John chapter 13. So it talks here in verse 2 that, you know, the devil's put into Jesus' heart. Oh, absolutely. And Jesus has got the money. And now he's looking for the opportunity. And anyway, so it says verse 4, Jesus rose from supper, during supper, laid aside his garments, took a towel, and girded himself. And probably they're all thinking to each other, what's the master doing, do you think? We're eating, and we've had the sort of the early course, and just getting juices are just flowing, and now Jesus got up and he's taken off his jacket and wrapping a big towel around himself. What was going on? After that, verse 5, he poured water into a basin and began to wash the disciples' feet and to wipe them with the towel with which he was girded. And of course, Judas was there still. So, can you imagine what's going through the minds of Jesus and Judas here, because this is at the Passover. They've kept the Old Testament sort of Passover part of the way through it, and Jesus stands up during the Passover and washes the feet of the disciples, and he comes to Judas. Now, Jesus knew for at least a year, I guess, possibly longer, who would betray him, and he's there washing Judas's feet and probably looking at Judas in the eye and thinking, last chance, Judas. And Judas is probably thinking, I've got 30 pieces of silver in my cabinet at home, because I'm going to betray you to be killed, and you're washing my feet, and you're the master. And you're just thinking, what's going through Judas's mind? Very hard to imagine. But Jesus, the Messiah, the Son of God, not just washing feet, which is bad enough in a sense, an example of humility, he's also washing the feet of Judas Iscariot, whom he knows is betraying him. Verse 6, then he came to Simon Peter, and Peter said to him, "Lord, are you washing my feet?" Jesus answered and said to him, "What I'm doing you do not understand now, but you will know after this." Peter said to him, "You'll never wash my feet." Jesus answered him, "If I do not wash you, you have no part with me." Simon Peter said to him, "Well, in that case, Lord, not my feet only, but also my hands and my head." And Jesus said to him, He who is bathed needs only to wash his feet, but is completely clean. And you are clean, but not all of you. For he knew who would betray him, therefore he said, you are not all clean. So when he had washed their feet, taken his garments, and sat down again, back at the meal table, he said to them, do you know what I have done to you? Or do you understand what I have done to you? And of course they didn't. You call me teacher, you know, rabbi, and Lord, and you say, well, for that's what I am. If I then, your Lord and teacher, have washed your feet, you also ought to wash one another's feet. I have given you an example that you should do as I have done to you. And I think one translation says, you're obligated to do what I have done to you. Most assuredly, I say to you, a servant is not greater than his master, nor is he who is sent, which you are, greater than he who sent him. If you know these things, happy are you if you do them. And so Jesus, before the bread and wine were instituted, as we'll see in a few moments, did the fruit washing. And at Passover every year, those of us who are baptized, you know, do undertake the fruit washing. And Jesus was setting a tremendous example of, you know, of humility and kindness and thoughtfulness. It says, I'm setting an example here. If I can do this, bearing in mind who I am, you likewise, okay? Verse 18, I do not speak concerning all of you. I know whom I have chosen, but that the scripture may be fulfilled, he who eats bread with me has lifted up his heel against me. Now I tell you, before it comes, then when it does come to pass, you may believe that I am he. Most assuredly I say to you, he who receives whomever I send receives me, and he receives me, or yet receives him who sent me. When Jesus had said these things, he was troubled in spirit and testified and said, most assuredly I say to you, one of you present here will betray me. Just making the point that Judas was there for the foot washing. He wasn't there for the bread and wine. Absolutely not. He was not worthy to participate in the bread and wine. And anybody today who is not worthy should not participate in the bread and wine. And Jesus set a good example there. So Judas was out by the time the bread and wine arrived. But he says, one of you will betray me. That wouldn't be easy for Jesus to say. Verse 22, then the disciples looked at one another, perplexed about whom he spoke. Now there was leaning on Jesus' bosom one of his disciples whom Jesus loved, which of course was John himself. Simon Peter therefore motioned to him to ask who it was of whom he spoke. Then, leaning back on Jesus' breast, he said to him, Lord, you know, who is it? Because they didn't know. I guess not as sharp as their master. Jesus answered, it is he to whom I shall give a piece of bread when I have dipped it. Having dipped the bread, he gave it to Judas Iscariot, the son of Simon. Now after the piece of bread, Satan entered him. Jesus said to him, possibly to Satan, what you do, do quickly. But no one at the table knew for what reason he said this to him. For some thought, because Judas had the money box, that Jesus said to him, buy those things we need for the feast of unleavened bread, or that he should give something to the poor. Having received the piece of bread, he then went out immediately, and it was night. So we've now got a situation where they've been eating the Old Testament Passover. Jesus got up in the middle of the meal, washed the feet, sat down, kept on eating. He's just given a piece of bread dipped in the broth to Judas. Judas takes the piece. Jesus says, get, right? I want you out of here now. Go. And so immediately Judas gets up and goes. And it was night. Now we turn to Matthew 26, again in verse 25. And we'll finish in just a moment or two. Matthew 26. And verse 25. Sorry, verse 23, let's pick it up. Verse 23. Matthew 26 tells us Jesus sitting with the disciples eating the Passover. If we could drop down to verse 23 of Matthew 26, Jesus' answer says, "He who dipped his hand with me in the dish will betray me. The Son of Man goes as it is written of him, but woe to that man by whom the Son of Man is betrayed. It would have been good for that man if he had not been born." Then Judas, who was betraying him, answered and said, "Rabbi, is it I?" He said to him, "You've said it." And so at that point, putting it together with John, Judas gets up and goes. "Get out of here." And then, look at verse 26, "And as they were eating, Judas having now gone, but nobody knows why, Jesus took bread, blessed it, broke it, gave it to the disciples and said, 'Take, eat, this is my body.' Then he took the cup, gave thanks, and said, 'Drink from it, all of you, for this is my blood of the new covenant, which is shed for many for the remission of sins.'" So that took place after Judas had disappeared. You know, Judas was not qualified to partake of the bread and wine. The guy was scheming to betray Jesus, you know, for money. And like Jesus said, "The man that's betraying me, oh, better for that man if he'd never been born." And so back to John chapter 13. So verse 30, it says, you know, Judas disappears, it was night time. Put that together with other parts of Matthew and Mark, and then Jesus brings out the New Testament emblems of bread and wine. Verse 31, "So when he had gone out, Jesus said, 'Now the Son of Man is glorified, and God is glorified in him. If God is glorified in him, God will also glorify him in himself, and glorify him immediately.' Little children, I shall be with you a little while longer. You will seek me, and as I said to the Jews, where I am going, you cannot come. So now I say to you, a new commandment I give to you, that you love one another. As I have loved you, that you also love one another. By this all will know that you are my disciples, if you have love for one another." Simon Peter said to him, "Lord, where are you going?" So blind, these guys. Jesus answered him, "Where I am going, you cannot follow me now, but you shall follow me afterward." Peter said to him, "Lord, why can I not follow you now? I will lay down my life for your sake." And that was, check that in the other Gospels, that was after the bread and the wine. Jesus answered, "Oh, will you lay down your life for my sake? Most assuredly, I say to you, the rooster shall not crow till you have denied me three times, Peter." And that's probably a good place to stop. So I will do that for now, and then we'll pick up the story, obviously, into the crucifixion itself next week. So with that, we'll conclude tonight's Bible study.